From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. We all know that medical care in this country is too damn expensive. Even people with health insurance are getting clobbered because their deductibles have soared in the last 10 years. There's been a big push to try to bring down costs by turning the healthcare industry into a marketplace where hospitals and doctors have to compete and patients are customers. The trouble is, buying an MRI or picking a doctor is nothing like buying a car or hiring a contractor. This hour on Point, trouble in the healthcare marketplace. Are you a price-savvy medical consumer? Have you price shopped for doctors or medical procedures? Did you find better care cheaper? Or do you think the whole idea of shopping for medical care is kind of a lost cause? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Noam Levy. He covers national healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times, and he's written a series of stories in recent months about what he calls the high deductible insurance revolution. And we've had him on the show a number of times, and his latest story is called Trying to Shop for Medical Care. Lots of luck with that. You can find a link to the whole series at onpointradio.org. Noam Levy, great pleasure to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Good to be with you.
So let's jump right into your piece and tell us about one of the central characters, Rebecca Grimm, who tried to be a smart shopper. She did everything that was sort of required of her to be a smart shopper when her second pregnancy ended in a miscarriage. What happened to her?
So Rebecca and Mark Grimm are a young couple who live in the outer suburbs of Indianapolis. He works as an IT specialist for a financial services company. They live in a modest house sort of in the outer suburbs. And as you mentioned, Rebecca, who's 29, had a miscarriage last year in her second pregnancy. And in order to clear the tissue from her body, she at first tried the lower cost option of a pill to take care of the medical need. That when that didn't work and she was told she would need a relatively straightforward outpatient surgical procedure to do this, she called a bunch of medical centers in her area to try to get the right price. The couple had a high deductible health insurance plan. They don't make a ton of money, and they were sensitive to the cost of medical care. She was told that the procedure would cost about $900. It was roughly the same at the medical centers that she checked out. She went to one of them a few miles from her house. The procedure requires about 15 minutes of sedation in an outpatient surgical center. She had it without complications. And when they got home, a few weeks later, a month or so later, they got a bill for almost $6,000.
See, it's amazing. So the estimate, just to be clear, the estimates came in at around $900 for this procedure. She had it done and then is billed almost $6,000. What happened?
Well, as you can imagine, the Grimms were floored.
Yeah.
They thought something must have gone wrong, as Mark Grimm told me. He said, I feel like I spent more time chatting with people at the front desk than my wife did in the back undergoing the procedure. Well, when they started calling the medical center to try to get an itemized bill for what had happened and try to understand why the cost was so out of whack with what she had been told it should cost, they learned that many of the costs associated with the procedure had not been included in the cost estimate. They finally succeeded in getting an itemized bill for this procedure, and they were floored to learn that there were 23 individual charges, including $65 for an anesthetic shot, $133 for two injections of a drug to prevent nausea, $132 for a liter of sterile water used in the procedure, $413 for the use of oxygen. The surgery itself.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, I'm just, it just floored me. $132 for a liter of sterile water. Unexpected.
Yeah, I mean, her brief stay in the recovery room, which again was, I think, less than half an hour, $720. Mm-hmm. And the surgery itself, two charges, one for $2,380 and one for $9,782. Now, as Rebecca told me when I visited with them in Indianapolis a month or so ago, she said, how in the world was I supposed to know that I needed to ask about each one of those individual prices? when I was going about picking a medical provider. And that, of course, is the conundrum that faces patients.
Right. So talk a little bit more about this. I mean, this was a revelatory part of your story, because I had no idea that pricing worked like this. I mean, I thought if you asked a hospital for, you know, basically what's this going to cost, they could give you a price. But as you explain, I mean, why is that so difficult? Even knowing that there are going to be 16 or 20 or 30 different components to the treatment, why can't they come up with a price estimate?
Well, they might be able to under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
But the big thing to understand here is that in American healthcare, there are about 10,000 individual billing codes. And this code, billing codes are the coin of the realm in American healthcare. Because if you know how to use billing codes, and there are schools devoted to teaching people to do nothing else than how to properly code medical procedures, that can be the difference between a hospital or a doctor's office going belly up or raking in tons of money. And so each one of these services, the everything from the liter of water to the $10,000 surgical procedure, has its own billing code associated with it. And so while it's true that some hospitals and some medical procedures can give you a what's called a bundled price, so it's one price, sort of like when you contract to have your house painted, you get a quote from the painter for this is how much it's going to cost. He doesn't charge you for each individual paintbrush and each individual mixing tool and each individual can of paint. You get a bundled price. But interestingly, when some researchers called 122 hospitals a few years ago around the country, two in each state and then some big teaching hospitals around the country, to try to get a single price for a hip replacement, which is a fairly straightforward, discrete medical procedure, only 19 of those 122 hospitals could actually give a price.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Noam Levy. He writes about national healthcare policy out of Washington for the Los Angeles Times. His latest story is headlined, Trying to Shop for Medical Care. Lots of luck with that. You can join the conversation. We want to hear your story. And then we're going to try later in the hour to talk a little bit about what can be done about this challenge. Let's go to Madan, who's calling from Edmond, Oklahoma. Madan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What's up?
So my wife is pregnant, and we are shopping around for which hospital to go to in Edmond, Oklahoma. It is so difficult to decide which hospital to go to because the rates are so different, so high. We have a high deductible plan. I'm thinking of changing my high deductible plan because the cost estimate is going somewhere in terms of $10,000, $14,000. So I can only understand that it's very complicated. So for someone who is educated, it is very difficult. For someone who is uneducated, it's going to be much more complicated to understand their medical bills. So I just wanted to get some perspective on that.
Madan, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for the call. Noam, I think it'd be useful to understand when we talk about high deductible plans, and we just heard Madan there who says he has one. How many Americans have these kinds of plans? Because they've really become very, very common for lots of working Americans, right?
They have. I mean, so the average deductible for a single plan, not a family plan, a single plan provided through an employer. And it's important to understand that about half of Americans still get their health coverage through an employer, has gone from around $300 12 or 15 years ago to almost $1,400 now. And that doesn't even account for, or it does account, but it doesn't make light of the fact that, like Madan mentioned, some people have deductibles. If they have a family plan, $5,000-$10,000 is not unusual at this point. So this kind of cost sharing is increasingly become the rule for job-based commercial health insurance in this country. And this is sort of this revolution that we've been examining in this series, which, you know, I think in many respects has gone underappreciated as we as a country in Washington in particular has sort of focused about Obamacare and the endless debates about what's going to happen to that healthcare law. This phenomenon, which started before the Affordable Care Act was enacted 10 years ago, has sort of slowly crept up on a lot of workers who simply don't have thousands of dollars lying around to pay an enormous deductible should they have an unexpected or even, for that matter, an expected medical cost.
What was the hope of these plans? I mean, I mentioned in the intro that the hope was to make us all sort of more savvy, but how was that supposed to work? I mean, how was it sort of marketed, I guess?
So it's important to understand that when these plans were being rolled out and sort of sold initially, we were at a time in this country about 20 years ago when HMOs were falling out of favor in a big way. There were lots of stories about people not being able to go to the doctors that they wanted to go to. And though the record of HMOs in terms of keeping healthcare costs in control was relatively good, a lot of Americans resented not being able to choose any hospital or any doctor that they wanted. Employers were struggling to deal with a backlash from their employees. They also were dealing with the fact that healthcare costs, which had remained relatively under control, started to inch back up. And conveniently, a group of mostly conservative health policy people sort of came forward with this idea that the missing piece in American healthcare was market-based thinking. This idea that we had seen what happened with televisions and computers, that as consumers got more choice and shopped around, the price for a lot of these goods and services came under control.
Noam, I'm going to jump right in. Hold that thought. We're going to pick it up right after the break. Listeners, we're talking about healthcare as a marketplace and whether you can shop for medical care. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and I'm talking with Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times about his latest story, which looks into what it's like to shop around for the cheapest blood test or MRI or doctor. It's a fascinating and actually dispiriting story, and you can find it on our website at onpointradio.org. And Noam, before the break, you were talking about the genesis of these high deductible plans, which encouraged us really to become savvy medical shoppers, and it might not be working out so well.
Well, that's right. So the idea, as I mentioned, was that healthcare ought to be something you can shop for in the same way that you buy a washing machine or, you know, select a bank where you want to open a checking account. Now, the idea was premised on the notion that healthcare ought to be more transparent, that, as we were talking about earlier, you ought to be able to call the hospital and get a price quote for your knee replacement, or you ought to be able to call an MRI center and get a quote for whatever imaging that you wanted to. And certainly it's true that there was then, and there still is today, a tremendous lack of transparency in the healthcare center. The other thing that has become increasingly clear is that there's an enormous price variation among hospitals and doctor's offices, even within one community of places a couple miles from each other, which suggested again to advocates of this particular strategy that this was a market, quote unquote, that was ripe for some sort of intervention to allow patients to guide their own care and use their own dollars. And sort of this notion that if patients had, quote unquote, skin in the game, that they would create a market, doctors and hospitals would have to respond to their demands, and prices would come under control. Of course, nothing of the sort happened.
Right. Let's get some callers into this conversation. Amanda is calling from Council Bluffs, Iowa. Amanda, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. You know, I'm not a medical professional. I don't know where to start doing this comparison shopping and what is or is not a good price. It seems what I would seem to be a lot of time. I don't have the time to research and compare procedures. You know, I'm all for being aware and trying to shop, but I haven't been given any baselines or resources, so it's not really helpful. Without a medical degree, how am I qualified to make these kind of decisions?
Amanda, it's a great question. And Noam, if you know, people like Amanda are sort of being encouraged to just go out there and look for the best price, they're not necessarily looking for the best medical care.
So we talked about whether or not hospitals and doctors are transparent in how much they charge.
Yeah.
Amanda, as you mentioned, brings up this very good question of also we need to know whether or not Dr. Smith is better than Dr. Jones or County General is better than, you know, Memorial Hospital on the other side of town. Turned out that data has also been missing. And in fact, there have been some interesting research more recently that even medical professionals confess to having a lot of trouble choosing one medical provider over another because, as we talked about earlier, healthcare is extremely complicated. And I think Amanda sort of gets at one of the fundamental issues which this high-deductible revolution has really exposed, and that is that most people want to get their medical care from somebody that they trust. If you are seeing an oncologist, if you have cancer, the chances that you are going to take an oncologist's recommendation about where to get your imaging done or where to have your surgery done or what kind of chemotherapy you should take, and then take those recommendations and go out and call around and say, like, well, I know, Dr. Jones, you suggested that I have my surgery done over here because you think that Dr. Smith is the best surgeon to remove this tumor from my abdomen. But I called around and it was $1,000 cheaper over there. I don't know many patients who would feel comfortable taking on that task, especially under conditions that presumably are pretty stressful if people are suffering from a serious illness. So again, at face value, it would appear that shopping for medical care is not the same as shopping for a washing machine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you mentioned that, and our caller made that point really well. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to bring up about this is it just seems that part and parcel of good medical care is developing a personal relationship with your doctor. And once you do that, you want to defer to that doctor. I mean, that just seems to be sort of part and parcel of good medical care. So, I mean, I'll just speak for myself personally. When my doctor says, you know, I want you to have this test, and here's a guy who knows how to do it, and if it needs follow-up, he's the guy to do it. I'm all set. It's like, this is my doctor. He's told me to do this. The last thing that's going to occur to me is to sort of challenge him and wonder, can I get this cheaper somewhere?
I'll tell you, Anthony, just really quickly, one of the other patients that we talked to for this story was a woman out in Oregon who needed to have a small cancerous growth removed from her nose, a Mohs surgery, it's called. And she also, like Rebecca Grimm, tried to shop around, got some price quotes, decided on going to the place that seemed to be the most economical. And when she was on the operating table and they had taken away some skin from her nose midway through the surgery, the doctor said, well, now we know how much of the nose tissue needs to be and skin needs to be reconstructed. Would you like us to take the skin from your ear or from your cheek? And she said, you know, I'm lying there on the operating table. The doctor is asking me which one of these two procedures I would prefer. At that point, the last thing I'm thinking about is shopping and price. I'm going to defer to my physician who's working on me, which is the best that's going to make my nose look the most like it did before I had this surgery. That's the reality for most patients,
right,
in the way they get medical care.
And what happened to her? Remind us, because you write about her in the piece, right? I mean, what happened
in terms of the billing?
Yeah.
Yeah, she got quoted a price. She said, well, you know, the various places that she called said, it's difficult for us to give you an accurate price because until we start operating on your nose, and this particular procedure requires the surgeon to take very slim pieces of skin away until all the cancerous tissue is gone. So sometimes it can be just a few slivers. Sometimes the procedure requires deeper incisions. We can't give you an exact price for that, but it will be anywhere between $3,000 and $8,000.
Wow.
So again, I mean, if you called an auto dealership and said, I'm looking to buy a new, you know, a new SUV, how much are they charging? And they said, well, we can't tell you until you actually buy it. It's going to be between $10,000 and $25,000. Inconceivable people would buy a car that way, of course. She ended up getting a bill in the end for about $5,000, which she had to pay because she had a high deductible plan.
Wow. No, I'm standby. I want to bring in Lynn Quincy. She's one of the people you interviewed for your story, and she used to be the healthcare advocate at Consumer Reports. Now she's director of the Healthcare Value Hub at the nonprofit research and consulting firm Altarum, and she joins us from Washington. Lynn Quincy, thanks for being with us.
I'm pleased to be here, Anthony.
Now, I know you've been listening along. By and large, you know, as I listen to Noam and read his excellent reporting, it leads me to conclude that you really can't shop for healthcare. I mean, do you agree with that? Is that a fair conclusion?
Absolutely. I think we know it anecdotally in our own lives. And there's also a host of really well done studies that show that we've been sold a bill of goods, essentially, that with the exception of a few procedures that are maybe not urgent, but really represent a minority of our healthcare spending. Shopping for healthcare is a mirage.
So what does that mean? I mean, because this has been at the core of the way our healthcare system has been designed and promoted for the last couple of decades.
Well, and I think that's a key point. I think it means that we need to stop buying into this strategy, this approach to controlling healthcare costs that doesn't work. We've got 15 years of experience with the strategy, and we have to begin to look at other ways to make our healthcare system work for the patients that are paying for it.
And what would be on top of your list in terms of the other ways? What are you referring to?
Well, it's not a silver bullet. There's not one thing, but I think there's a whole host of things. And I think we need to start with, what do consumers want? What kind of a healthcare system do they want? Well, their top concerns are they want the system to be affordable, they want it to be less complex, and they want it to be fair. And to me, that implies strategies that really even out the big inequities in our healthcare system, standardizing how do you get healthcare? How much do you pay for it? What kind of healthcare is it when you get it? I loved the point that Amanda made when it came to shopping. She said, there's no baseline.
Mm.
And that refers to the fact nobody sort of put a stake in the ground and said, this is a fair price and this is the minimum level of quality. I think consumers would really like that if policymakers at the state or federal level would make those types of declarations so consumers know where they stand vis-a-vis the system.
Great points. I want to go back to our callers. Listeners, you can join in. What do you make of this longstanding trend now of high deductible health insurance policies and this idea that you ought to be thinking about how to become a savvy healthcare shopper? Is it working? Has it worked for you? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Beth. She's calling from Kingsport, Tennessee. Hi, Beth. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. Here in the Kingsport area, 100-mile radius, we used to have two primary medical groups and hospitals that we could choose from. They have now merged. So we have really no options to shop around. There's only one player within 150-mile radius that we can use to get our medical services. And you can go to a different hospital, but they all have the same rate. So the idea of shopping when they've merged is just not possible anymore.
Well, it's a great point. Noam, I'd love to sort of turn that to you. I mean, we're reading every day about hospital mergers. So what Beth is describing must be increasingly frequent for people across the country.
It absolutely is. And it just raises one more barrier to patients if they even have the inclination and the ability to shop. Healthcare is becoming increasingly consolidated. Not only are hospitals joining with each other, but hospitals are increasingly purchasing medical practices. So if you go see Dr. Jones, Dr. Jones is going to refer you to the hospital group that he is a part of, again, making it that much more difficult for people to sort of leave systems and go about comparing prices from one place to another.
I want to talk again. Noam, you brought up transparency, and I want to listen to a little bit of tape from Seema Verman. She's an administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, known as CMS. It's part of the Department of Health and Human Services. And in a speech she delivered in January, she said there isn't enough price transparency in the health industry, but that the current administration is trying to do something about that.
We demand to know the cost of virtually everything that we buy. So why shouldn't we demand price transparency from the healthcare system? This has been talked about for years, but we are finally taking action because transparency creates competition, and competition keeps prices down because patients can shop. And starting this year, CMS now requires hospitals to post their standard price information online in a format that can be electronically accessed and where people can actually find it.
So that was Seema Verma, administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Lynn Quincy, is that happening? She seems to be describing something that would move us toward price transparency.
Well, there are new federal rules designed to increase transparency. Will they make a big difference? The data to date says perhaps not, but I will make an additional point. There are audiences for healthcare price transparency beyond just consumers. Employers and policymakers, they actually, in a way, are better positioned to make use of that type of information, particularly if it can identify where pricing outliers are in a market and things like that. So there's a whole other use of transparency that is maybe off topic for this show, but that we want to keep in mind.
Sure. Let's go to Laura. She's calling from Springfield, Illinois. Laura, thanks for the call, and go ahead.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I fall into the category of a retired person who depends on Medicare and a supplemental insurance. And I had an experience 2 years ago of where I was facing a fairly common surgery most of us in my age group face, which is cataract surgery. So I, of course, talked with my doctor, got a price from him, which he stuck by in the end. I tried to contact the hospital that did the surgeries or provided the surgery suites for this particular doctor, could not get any information out of them until they knew the complete diagnosis and a code. In the end, everything went well. Had I had to pay for the entire surgery for two eyes, it would have been roughly $25,000. I think it's outrageous. However, I was lucky. I came out well on it, but I still had to pay my part of it. On a payment plan.
Right. Laura, thanks so much for that story. Noam Levy, I want to ask you about what Laura was talking about. I mean, it sounded like she really did her homework and had a pretty decent medical facility and doctor to work with to make sure that they stuck by the original estimate.
And they very well may have. I don't mean to suggest that all medical providers are not able to provide information. But I think what one of the points that Laura brings up, which I think is incredibly important here, is that even as patients have been asked to shoulder larger and larger shares of the bills, there's been no indication that the underlying prices that hospitals and doctors are charging have been moderating. In fact, if you look at knee replacement surgery, for example, the average price of a knee replacement surgery in this country has gone up 80% over the last decade or so, about twice the rate of inflation. That's at the same time that patients have had, quote unquote, more skin in the game. So the argument that if patients had to shoulder more of the bill, somehow hospitals or doctors or drug makers for that matter, which of course we could do a whole show on as well, that they would control the price of their products has been shown to be folly. And that, you know, cataract surgery is a great example of that, of something that is shoppable. A lot of people provide it, and yet look how expensive it is.
Really interesting. We're talking to Noam Levy. He writes about national healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times. You can check out his story, Trying to Shop for Medical Care. Lots of luck with that. We're going to continue our conversation after the break. Also with us is Lynn Quincy. She's director of the Healthcare Value Hub at the nonprofit research and consulting firm Alterum. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Is the push to make healthcare consumers savvy shoppers working out? That's the question we're exploring this hour. Do you even want to shop for doctors for MRIs and knee replacement surgeries to find the best price? Frank Esposito from Long Island, New York, was blindsided by medical bills of over $650,000 for back surgery his doctors told him was critically necessary. Here he is speaking to CBS News in a story that ran earlier this week.
Well, it was my choice. Just be paralyzed for the rest of my life. Then to get these bills that were so overwhelming, you say that this can't be real. I mean, I really don't have to pay this. How am I going to pay this? And you sit there and you start crying because you don't know what you're going to do.
And here from that same CBS story is Aaron Carroll, professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine, talking about Frank Esposito's experience.
This is somebody who's in pain and now has been told, okay, you might be paralyzed unless you run to the hospital. How are they supposed to become good shoppers and make complex, rational decisions? They're going to say, please tell me what to do, because that's your job.
My guest is Noam Levy, healthcare policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times. You can link to his story, Trying to Shop for Medical Care. Lots of luck with that. Also with me is Lynn Quincy, director of the Healthcare Value Hub at the nonprofit research and consulting firm Alterum. And Lynn, let me come to you. I want to ask you this. Is there a kernel of truth in the idea that it would be a good idea, a good goal, if we could empower healthcare consumers in some way? And that was sort of the original idea here, empowering patients essentially to take charge of their own health care, but it just didn't work out. But is the sort of central or like one of the kernels in that idea a good one?
Well, I think that the original idea really was never coming at it from a true consumer perspective or a true patient perspective. It was just a hope that economic theory would save the day.
Interesting. Okay.
But I do think that if we were to start there, consumers are suffering, and they do feel completely powerless to navigate the healthcare market, as every story we've heard today illustrates. So the idea of making it work better for consumers and empowering them in the way they want to be empowered, I think that is something worth pursuing. As an example, they wouldn't mind choosing among good, safe choices. So there's no like pitfall where the bill is going to be unexpected or the quality is going to be unexpectedly bad or the health plan has a big gap in the coverage that you couldn't have possibly known about. You know, if we make the marketplace a lot safer for them so they can't make a misstep, they will feel empowered and they might be willing to choose among those remaining options.
All right, interesting. Let's go to our callers again. Kay is calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. Kay, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Please go ahead.
Hi, yes. I just disagree a little bit with a few of the problems that the people have had. I realize when you're in an emergency situation, you don't have time to compare. But one of the things like MRIs, that type of thing, where maybe you've got a little time to shop around, I saved almost $900 difference from checking with three different hospitals to get an MRI, which was the exact same MRI at any hospital I would go to. The other thing I would warn people about, too, are these so-called pharmacy benefit plans where you are directed to a certain pharmacy. You don't have to go there, but they tell you you're going to get this great price there. And it sounded like I would. So it's offered by Medicare, and then it's also typically offered by employers. And I was paying $145 for this particular medication, and I was telling someone about it, and they said, that sounds like a lot. And I started checking around, and I found it for $80 somewhere else.
So from $145 to $80. Kay, thanks so much for the call. I really appreciate that. Noam, what do you hear in Kay's call there?
Well, I think Kay points to the fact that there are certain services in healthcare, prescription drugs may be an example of this as well, where it is a relatively easy to compare one thing against another. One MRI isn't that different from another MRI. You go in, you get your MRI, you come out. There's not a sort of long course of treatment, and it may be that there are some of these discrete services and products that could be sort of shopped effectively. I think the broader issue is how much of what Americans are spending on medical care is constituted by those kinds of services. There's been some research on this, and it's pretty small. So, for example, the Healthcare Cost Institute, which is a Washington-based think tank, looked at the total amount of money that was spent on people who have commercial health insurance. It's about $500+ billion a year, I think, in the year that they looked at it. Of that $500+ billion, about 7% was deemed to be shoppable in any real sense. Hmm. Because it was a service like we talked about that was discreet and could be planned ahead of time, and because it was subject to out-of-pocket spending. So there was a deductible associated with it. So bear in mind, for people who have very, very expensive care, which is, by the way, driving the overall cost problem we're having, not too many MRIs, many of those services are not really shoppable because they're so expensive that they are mostly covered by health insurers. So consumers would have little incentive to actually shop for them in any real way.
Let's go to David, who's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Go ahead, David. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. I'm a healthcare provider. You had an earlier caller who identified simplicity, cost containment, and quality as the goals of any healthcare system. My firm opinion is that that can only be provided by a single-payer system. Healthcare is far too important and far too complex to be governed by the profit motive.
All right, David. Well, thank you. Thank you for that call, and I appreciate it coming from, in particular, from a healthcare provider. Lynn Quincy, is that where this discussion leads you? In other words, if we want transparency, if we want simplicity, does it mean we have to get serious about considering a single-payer system?
Well, I think it's extremely useful that the country is having a robust debate about that. And the problem is that single payer means different things to different people. Mm. We, at the Healthcare Value Hub, we did do a deep dive to see where are there sort of automatic savings and improvements from using single payer, and where would the kind of health system we want to see have to be sort of built in as an extra thing. So, for example, when you have a single payer, you are really evening out that price variation that Noam has been talking about, and that's really important, and there's probably a lot of savings there. You're probably reducing administrative complexity, and that's important, and there's savings there. But we do have, even though we don't have, the utilization problem isn't as bad as the high price problem, utilization fixes aren't automatic, so there sort of have to be, you'd have to layer in extra stuff to make sure we're not having low-value care and we are consuming enough high-value care. So it's a mix, it's something that should be on the table, but we also need to be super smart about how we implement it.
Right. I'm wondering, as you look around the world at other sort of developed economies, when we talk about healthcare markets, are there healthcare markets that work better in other countries, in your view, Lynn?
Yes, I think so. And everybody has a different idea of what it means to work better. For some people, it might be how well is it working for the consumer. For others, it might be do you have robust competition. So different countries will check those boxes, you know, depending on which box you want to check. But I will say that there are many examples of developed countries where whatever rubric you pick, their healthcare system is working better.
Right. So let's check the working better for consumer box. Where would you go? Where would be sort of the best example of a healthcare market that works well?
Well, I'm not going to give maybe a best, but I will say much of Europe looks at our system and it seems very barbaric to them because of the inequities we have, because it's so difficult for Americans to navigate. And I don't really need to pick one, but a lot of their systems in which everybody is under a similar system. It's not different systems depending on how old you are and whether you have employer coverage and whether or not you can afford it. You know, everybody is treated quite equally. Everybody knows how to navigate the system. It's not difficult to navigate. The quality is good. So we can point to any number of examples over there.
Let's go to Ciara. She's calling from Waycross, Georgia. Ciara, am I pronouncing your name correctly, first of all?
Oh, yes, you are. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Ciara, thanks so much for the call. What's on your mind?
I'm just thinking, me and my husband, we're both young. We have two children, but I know that we've considered, especially before we had children, not even having health care coverage because of the expensive cost, because we're both healthy, not using it at all, maybe, you know, for an entire year. And I'm just wondering how many young people are put in that same situation where they consider the cost of healthcare coverage and the fact that they're healthy and they're never going to use it most likely, but then maybe they get stuck in a position where they get in a car accident and, you know, thousands of dollars in medical bills come their way. I know that, you know, we consider not having it and it just scares me for other people that are young like us.
Ciara, it's a great question. Noam, I'm wondering if you have any data from your reporting in answer for Ciara.
Well, the uninsured rate in this country has sort of come down fairly substantially since passage of the Affordable Care Act, although it's notched up a little bit in the last year or two. It's now below 10%. But a large number of the uninsured in this country are, in fact, younger people who are making exactly the calculation that Ciara is making. It's obviously a risky one because no matter how high a deductible can be, a major medical event can have hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills.
Absolutely.
Associated with it.
And no, I'm just sticking with sort of a related point to Ciara's call, which you touch on in your piece. This issue of high deductibles and big out-of-pocket costs, you found lots of people are making difficult decisions about how to cover those costs, right?
We are, and we explored this sort of more fully in some earlier installments in the series. But as part of this project, we did a nationwide poll with the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation, focusing exclusively on people who have job-based health insurance, which traditionally has been sort of the gold standard in coverage in terms of how robust the protections are. And we were prepared to hear a fair amount from people about the struggles they were having with medical bills. But I will tell you, those of us, the paper who worked at this, as well as people at the foundation, I think were stunned at the scope of the suffering that's out there. I'll share with you just one statistic, which I just think is chilling. And that is that 1 in 6 Americans who have job-based coverage say they or a close family member have had to make a difficult sacrifice just in the last year to pay for health care. And we're talking – we gave people an opportunity to share just little snippets. What are you talking about when you say difficult sacrifice? And people were saying things like, I've been eating like a bird. I'm not buying presents for my kids at the holidays. I can't celebrate my 25th wedding anniversary. I've had to take on 3 jobs. So I think there's a level of which your callers today really testify to. There is a level of suffering, frankly, out there among people who have health insurance that I think is an order of magnitude different than may have been the case a generation ago, when the issue was people don't have health coverage, and that's sort of brings up its own issues. Now we're talking about people who have health coverage can't afford medical care.
Mm. Lynn Quincy, I want to bring you back. And you know, I was really struck by Ciara's call, a young healthcare consumer who asked a really good question about, you know, and honestly, a distressing question to my mind, you know, should I go without health insurance given the cost?
Well, and yeah, this to me ties back to Noam's story, which is about high deductibles. When people see a deductible that they can't ever imagine bridging, the health insurance policy that they're considering buying doesn't really appear to have any value to them. It just seems like they're paying all this premium, but they're almost certainly not going to gain any benefit. So it's a whole nother reason to rethink this approach to cost sharing, because it's not our only approach. We could design these policies much differently so that people are more inclined to buy them because they see some more immediate value in the policy that they're buying.
Right. Final question. I'll put it to you, Lynn. I mean, absent some radical change in our healthcare system coming soon to a neighborhood near you, what's your best advice to patients trying to navigate our current healthcare system that at least for the, you know, the midterm, long term, even is going to be the one we have with these high deductible plans? What's your best advice?
Well, first of all, do your very best not to be uninsured. Second, look, whatever policy you buy and that deductible, try to pair it with what you are able to afford. And if you have the option of buying a more generous plan that you can afford that ensures that you can bridge that gap created by the deductible, do so. And be upfront with your providers. Say, I'm on a high deductible plan, which essentially means you're uninsured for in the near term. What can you do for me? A lot of times, providers, they don't want to see their patients suffering. They really would like to treat them in such a way that it's as affordable as possible, and they'll probably work with you. Mm. And then, of course, let's get some policy changes in the longer run.
Amen to that. Lynn Quincy, director of the Healthcare Value Hub of the nonprofit research and consulting firm Alterum. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us today. Very grateful to you.
Thank you.
And Noam Levy, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for your excellent reporting. We really appreciate it. Thanks for kicking off this important discussion today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Anthony.
That's Noam Levy, healthcare writer for the Los Angeles Times. You can find a link to his piece, Trying to Shop for Medical Care. Lots of luck with that. You can also find a link to the other pieces in his series. That's it. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justin Down, Eileen Amata, Steph Consonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.